Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. And I'm working on a second book titled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 143. I'm recording it on Saturday, 20th, 2009. The P10 level today is 16. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by our friend Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. Thank you, Kevin, for helping out with the music. The title of this selection is Rocking. The title of the podcast is The Intrinsic... It's a strange one. One of those paradoxical titles. The title is The Intrinsic Value of Stocks is a Secret We Keep from Ourselves. Is that an Alfred Hitchcock title? Or what? The idea discussed in this podcast is breakthrough. It's huge. It's one of those ideas, you can state it in a sentence or two, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to circle around in on it. And the reason I want to do that is if I state it in a sentence or two, I'm afraid you won't grasp the significance because it is huge. Determining the intrinsic value of the stocks that you buy is the equivalent of finding the Holy Grail or finding the fountain of youth. It's something that mankind has been trying to do for years, unsuccessfully. And we now have available to us the tools we need to determine the intrinsic value of the stocks we buy. And with very little effort on our part, very, very little effort. And credit for this breakthrough goes to a lot of people, but primarily to John Bogle, Mr. Passive Investing. You've heard me refer to something called the indexing revolution. John Bogle popularized indexing as an investing strategy with his founding of the Vanguard Fund Group in the late 1970s. And indexing changes all the rules of investing. And what indexing does, and I don't know of anyone else who has made this point, Bill Bernstein came close in his book, The Four Pillars of Investing. I don't think he brought it out clearly enough, but he made references to it. But it's so big. It's so big. I feel like I've made this comment. I say that since I've learned about the rational investing model, I look at everything I read about investing with X-ray vision. I see things, you know, like Superman. I see things nobody else can see. And every day I learn new things. And it's both wonderful and horrible because I see all these things and I'm excited to tell my friends about them, but when I tell my friends about them, you know, some of them get upset because I'm not endorsing passive investing, and instead of being happy, instead of saying thanks, man, you know, they start throwing bricks at my head, and that makes me sad. But anyway, we have the power today. No, if you know the intrinsic value of the stocks you buy, intrinsic value essentially means real value. You know, not some price assigned by the market, the real value of the stocks you buy. If you know the intrinsic value of the stocks you buy, you have pretty much eliminated risk from the investing equation. We don't know the intrinsic value perfectly, so I can't tell you we've eliminated risk altogether. That would be an overstatement. But, and I don't know if I can say to the extent to which we've eliminated stock risk, but it's more than half, certainly more than half of the risk of stocks disappears when you know the intrinsic value. I would say it's something in the neighborhood of 70 to 80% of the risk is gone. So this is huge. I'm going to tell you in this podcast how to know the intrinsic value of the stocks you buy. And it's not going to be complicated. It's not going to take effort on your part. It's not going to take research. It's very easy. I'll start by telling you, and then I'll circle back, and then perhaps, you know, when we hit it this, on the second go, it'll click. But the basic concept is people used to buy individual stocks through history. And someone like Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is recognized as the most successful investor in history. What Warren Buffett is trying to do with all the research he does and all the intelligence, you know, he's acquired over the years and all the experience, what he's trying to do with all that work is to determine the intrinsic value of the stocks he buys. That's really all he's doing. You know, there's a lot of things involved in that. There have been books and books and books written about it, but that's what he's doing. So what he does is, you know, he'll look at a stock, you know, just to take an example, say it's, Apple Computer, he will look at it, do all sorts of research, you know, the management, the products, the financial statements, all these things, whether they have a moat, all these things, how strong their competition is, and at the end of all that, his goal is to make a statement of intrinsic value. He wants to say, well, based on all this analysis, Apple Computer, a share of Apple Computer is worth $30. And then he checks the selling price. And if the selling price is $27, he doesn't buy it. Because there's a concept that value investors follow called margin of safety. And if you determine that the intrinsic value of the stock is $30 and you have to pay $27 for the stock, the idea is that's just too close. Your calculations might be a little bit off, and the true intrinsic value might be 25, and you might be paying 27, and you're losing money. So you need a margin of safety, they call it. But if Apple's selling for 15 or 10, and he's determined that the intrinsic value is 30, he buys. And of course, he makes lots of money. And every now and then he gets one wrong, but if you get most of them right and you've got a margin of safety built in, the few that you get wrong, it's going to work out. It's going to be fine. Well, to teach you how to invest like Warren Buffett, this is what? What was the number? 143? I'd have to do, 1,000 of these podcasts to go through all the things that Warren Buffett knows in detail. But with indexing, it's so easy. It's so easy. It blows my mind. I don't know of anyone else talking about this today, and there's got to be some other smart people who have caught on to this, but I don't know who they are. I've never heard Bogle say it. And he should be saying it because, as I say, he's the one that's popularized indexing. Well, what indexing does is it makes the calculation of intrinsic value a snap. Because when you buy an index fund, a broad index fund, the S&P or the total stock market index, what you're essentially buying is the productivity of the U.S. economy. You're not buying one company. You're not buying Apple, or Campbell Soup. And the beauty of this is, if you're going to put your money in Apple or Campbell Soup, you better investigate those companies. If you put it in the whole U.S. economy, you're covered. The U.S. economy, we have records, and the U.S. economy has been productive enough to support, to finance an increase in the broad stock index of roughly 6.5% real, going back decades and decades. So, it may not be 6.5 going forward from today. It might be 6, or it might be 7, depending on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist. But the odds are awfully strong it's going to be somewhere in that neighborhood. So the intrinsic value is being handed to you on a silver platter. The intrinsic value of an investment in a broad U.S. index fund is it's an asset that's going to provide you every, if you know how to invest, it's an asset that's going to provide you a return of 6.5% real. That's the intrinsic value. Now, we've got to get this message out because Bogle hasn't been teaching this and no one else is teaching it. And the result is we've been instead teaching passive investing, which says we don't know the intrinsic value. Passive, the reason you're passive is you don't know anything about what the price should be, and therefore you just invest passively. You just say, I'll do whatever the market does because I know nothing. And if you know the intrinsic value and you know the market has it wrong, then obviously you don't want to go along with the market. You want to invest according to intrinsic value, not according to market price. So we're doing the opposite. We've been spending hundreds of millions of dollars promoting passive investing, teaching people to ignore intrinsic value when the beauty of indexing is that it makes the calculation of intrinsic value as simple as it could possibly be. Now, I just want to explain, how is it that when you buy an index fund, intrinsic value is so easy to calculate when it's so hard with a company? Well, the reason is with Apple Computer, the range of possibilities is great. If Apple is trying to come out with a new product and it's a hit, you know, the iPhone, and it's a hit, the value of that company is going to skyrocket. Apple, from the time they developed the iPhone, the value of that stock skyrocketed. And on the other hand, if some competitor comes out with something better than the iPhone, the price of Apple Computer is going to go down hard. So calculating the intrinsic value is a hard job. That's what somebody like Warren Buffett tries to do, but it's not for you or me to do unless we put a lot of effort into it. With the broad U.S. stock index, you don't have to worry about whether the company you buy has a hit product or not. It doesn't matter because you're buying, you know, if it's the S&P 500, you're buying 500 companies, big companies. And if it's the total U.S. stock market, it's thousands of companies. But the point is, some of those companies are going to have hit products. Some of them are going to have, you know, dismal failures. Some of them are going to have a mix. It's going to even out. What you do when you buy an index is you you're diminishing risk. That's what you're doing. Instead of putting all your eggs in one basket, you're spreading out and thereby making it easier to determine intrinsic value. You can't get as many home runs as you could if you calculated intrinsic value yourself. What Warren Buffett is trying to do is saying, well, I know the intrinsic value and none of the other investors do, so I can jump in and get buys that these other people can't get. You give that up when you become an indexer, but you get something of great value, and that's intrinsic value. And it's the horrible tragedy of the first 30 years of promotion of this investing approach is this has all been overlooked. It's all been ignored. And we've been teaching people to invest passively, which means ignore intrinsic value. The greatest asset of indexing is that you know intrinsic value starting out, and we've been throwing that away. We've been throwing away that advantage. What passive investors do is they say, I'll stay at the same allocation no matter what the market price is. Well, if you know the intrinsic value and the market price is three times intrinsic value, you obviously don't want to be staying at the same stock allocation. You want to be going with a high stock allocation when the market price is lower than intrinsic value, which is what Buffett does. When the odds are on your side, you want a high stock allocation. And when the market price is three times fair value, you don't want to be going with a high stock allocation. You want to be going with a low stock allocation or no stock allocation. You want to be protecting your portfolio. So by promoting passive investing, the indexers have forfeited the greatest benefit of indexing. It's sad. Very sad. Now, what I find in trying to think about these ideas myself and also teach them to others is that most of these ideas don't click the first time you hear them. You have to look at them from different angles. And as you see how things work over and over again, from different angles, the knowledge gets sharper and stronger, clearer. The way I describe it, it's when I wrote my book on saving, my first book. This analogy works very well. Writing that book was like watching a photograph develop in front of your eyes. You know, I don't know if when you used to get Polaroids, you know, you would pull the film out and it took a minute or two and it would develop in front of your eyes. And that's except with the book, it took years. But the first cut at it, all the ideas were there, but they were foggy. They weren't crisp. They weren't clear. And then as I rewrote it a second time, they were better, but they still weren't there. And then the third time, it's getting there. And the fourth time, yeah, this follows. This works. And the fifth time, it's polished. It gets better. The same thing is true with all these ideas about investing. You can't look at them once, listen to one podcast, read one article, and say, yeah, I got it. You know, I'm going to go on with my business. You've got to come back to it over and over again. None of these ideas are hard. None of these ideas are complicated. It's just we are trying to overcome this marketing campaign, this massive marketing campaign by the stock selling industry to promote passive investing. And we have to figure out in our own heads why that's wrong. And we have to understand clearly why it's wrong. And they're going to undermine us, not intentionally, but, you know, they're still marketing this stuff. And you're going to hear it. You're going to hear all these marketing slogans. And you have to instantly know. You have to know this stuff on a deep enough level that none of the trickery, and again, not intentional, but none of the trickery will work when you know your stuff. So you have to come back to it. So I want to circle around and talk about how it is that I came this afternoon to be thinking about the intrinsic value question. And what happened is, I always talk about, well, I should give credit to Shaddox. Shaddox is a screen name of the fellow who runs a blog called Money and Such. It's a very high-quality blog. He's an intelligent fellow. And Shaddox, I've been writing about valuation-informed indexing in a number of blogs in the past few months. Some of them I've gotten a great reception. Some of them, you know, sort of in the middle. And some of them hostile. Some of them just ignore me, of course. But Shaddox has been my favorite. He's smart, but he's more than smart. I don't know what word to use, but he's the word that comes to mind is righteous. He's righteous. He does things the right way. He's got the right attitude. He does not agree with all that I'm saying about investing, long-term timing. He's skeptical. But what Shaddox said to me the first day I suggested running a blog, he said, this is an interesting topic. He said, you've got some provocative words here. He said, yeah, I'll run this, but let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to run your blog entry and your guest blog entry, and I'm going to come back the next day, and I'm going to write a rebuttal. And I said, my man, Shaddox, that's the way to go. I wish all the passive investing advocates would do that. You know, run the other idea, let people see it, and then if you think it's wrong, do a rebuttal. And you get people thinking. You see, if you're confident in your ideas, you can do that. Many passive investing advocates lack confidence in their ideas, and they're defensive, they're frightened, they're timid. And so they don't want people to hear new ideas. But not Shaddox. He's a righteous blog owner. So he did that, and I ran a blog entry, and he ran a response. And at the end of that, I said, well, how about another one of these? And he said, fine, and I did another one. And the second one, he was a little more convinced. You know, he's coming around on some points, still skeptical, though, on some points. And we've agreed to do a third one, but we're going to take a break. So in a couple weeks, we'll do another one. But during the second one, there's another fellow. He goes by the name Frank Curmudgeon, and he runs an a blog called Bad Money Advice, which I also like. And but Frank would not run a guest blog entry by me, and the reason he gave is that he doesn't agree with me, and he feels that his blog should be things that he believes in. But he's unsure, and so he seems to have an open mind. And so he came on these Shaddox blogs and posted some good questions. And he threw a question at me at one of them, I think the second one, or I think it was Shaddox's rebuttal on the second one. And it threw me a little bit. It got me thinking about this stuff, and that's always good. That's where this blog, this podcast came from. And, you know, the point I make, which I make over and over and over again, is the two most important realities of stock investing you need to understand to be successful in the long run is short-term timing never works. We learned that from the passive investors. That's their big breakthrough insight. Long-term timing always works. That's been the great mistake. That's the one the passive investors got wrong. They concluded, when they determined that short-term timing never works, they concluded that no form of timing works. So the way they say it is timing never works. It's every bit as accurate to say timing always works as it is to say that timing never works, because long-term timing always works. And it's the same historical data that shows both things. The difference is short-term timing is you change your allocation expecting to see a benefit in a year, something like that, a year, maybe two. Long-term timing is you change your allocation in response to big price changes, understanding that you may not see a benefit for doing so for 5 years, possibly even 10 years, usually within 5 years, sometimes 1 year, you know, sometimes it happens real quick, but you understand going in that it could take 5 years or possibly even 10 years. That always works. Now, and the reason it works in very simple form is just that the price you pay for stocks has to affect the long-term value proposition. So, you know, what would you think would happen? Of course, if you buy stocks when they're overpriced, the long-term value proposition is poor. And if you're heavily invested in stocks when they're at insane prices, you're going to get bad returns on your money. But if you're heavily invested in stocks at times when the price is good, you're going to do very well. So long-term timing always works. Long-term timing is really just another phrase for saying pay attention to price. There's no other way to pay attention to the price of the stocks you buy other than to time the market. There is no other possibility. The only way you can do it is to lower or increase your stock allocation. So when they say timing never works, what they're really saying is don't pay attention to the price of stocks. And gee, I wonder why the people trying to sell us stocks would tell us that, you know. I wonder why that's such a popular marketing slogan. Timing never works. It's impossible the timing would never work. It's totally impossible. So anyway, I made this point. But Frank, who was also skeptical and smart, you know, and open-minded, like Shaddox, he said, okay, Rob, fine. You're telling us short-term timing never works. Long-term timing always works. He says, okay, how does the market know that we've moved from the short-term into the long-term? I love basic questions. How does the market know, Rob? A very basic question, and that makes it a very good question. And it threw me a little bit because it's a good question. How does the market know? And I'm going to go through a couple answers, but ultimately I rejected them. I think they all may play a part. All these answers may have something to do with it, but I don't think any of them really get at it until the one I give at the end. But the answer I gave in my response to Frank, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because almost as soon as I wrote it, I began to lose confidence in it. I think the answer has some truth in it. I don't think it's wrong, but I don't... The answer's too mechanistic. It doesn't rub me the right way. So I think we all have a tendency to want to give mechanistic, logical answers to investing questions. And This is because of the influence of the passive investing era. Passive investors love mechanistic answers. And we all want to impress them. You know, they've been so dominant for so long that we feel these are the people we need to persuade, you know, to get in the club, you know. And we have to stop that because, you know, they're nice people, but they've got a lot wrong. And the idea that there has to be a logical answer to everything, that's what got passive investing on the wrong track in the first place. This is a little bit of a tangent, but there was a thread at a big blog, Get Rich Slowly blog, and there was a fellow there, Dave Schaefer. I had the goons attacking me on that thread, and Dave Schaefer, a good guy, and he's a financial planner, and he was, you know, he came to my defense and said, no, these ideas really make a lot of sense. The goons were saying, well, Rob, you've got to tell us exactly what allocation to be at all the different P10 levels. Rob, if you can't tell us that, then you don't really have a scheme. Of course, I don't have a scheme. All I have is common sense, but I don't want to have a scheme. I've refused to answer that question because I think it's an idiotic question. I can give general ideas, you know, the sort of stock allocation you should be at the different P10 levels, but I can't give one number. Because that's just phony. It's artificial. And there is no one number. Any more than John Bogle can give you one stock allocation that everybody should have. It's an idiotic thing to think that we could have such a thing, that we could know such a thing. And one of the things we have to start doing is acknowledging what we don't know. That's the big thing missing in investing advice today. That everybody thinks to be an expert, you've got to act like you know it all. And the truth is, none of us know it all. And when we act like big shots, we get stuff wrong, and then we don't want to admit we're wrong, and we end up causing, you know, crashes and people to lose out on their retirements and the entire economy going into crisis because we can't admit these mistakes. So we got to stop that nonsense, being big shots. We got to learn how to say, you know, this is what I think, but not what I know. You know, there are some things we know, and we should say that. But the things we don't know, the things we're not sure, we have to be less dogmatic, less full of ourselves. So, you know, Dave said, Rob, he says, I understand what you're saying. We can't really give an exact number, but look, you're never going to persuade these people if you're not willing to play their game. You're going to have to do a chart, you know, listing the numbers. I said, Dave, look, I'm happy to persuade these people if they want to be persuaded, but, you know, them deciding they want to be persuaded, that's an inside job. Them opening themselves to new ideas, that's an inside job. I can't tell them. I can't give them motivation to want to be effective stock investors. We've got millions of middle-class investors want to know what works. Those are my readers. Those are my listeners. Those people are happy to hear the truth, the real story. They don't need this bogus BS. And so I'm telling it the way it is, and if some passive investing dogmatic isn't pleased with that, you know, it's just too bad. So I'm not playing that game. I played that game a little bit. I remember early in the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate, they used to club me over the head. Rob, you know, John Graney had said the optimal allocation is 74%, and they said, Rob, what do you say it is at these price levels? And I said, well, I don't know. I said, we haven't done enough research. And they kept clubbing me over the head, and I finally said, well, maybe 50%. And I just really picked a number that was, you know, I knew it had to be a good bit lower than 74 because I knew he had done the calculation wrong. And I regret that because it turned out when we did all the research, it was 20%. It wasn't 50%. So I was wrong. I just never imagined it could be, you know, the numbers could be as off as they were. It boggled my mind. But I shouldn't have broke down. So anyway, the point of all this is we have to stop breaking down and going along with the passive investing games because passive investing games will always lead us on the wrong track. And we have to stop that. Rational is a new model. It's a different model. It's a more humble model. And we're not going to play those games. We're not going to give schemes. So my first answer to Frank's question, how does the market know when we've shifted from short-term into long-term, was a little too scheme-like for my taste. So I'm not crazy about it, but I'll go through it quickly. What I answered was that when you are at fair value, there are studies that have been done that have shown that two-thirds of the return, the long-term return from stocks, comes from dividends. So the long-term return, the average long-term return, is something in the neighborhood of 6% real. Roughly 4% of that comes from dividends, and 2% from increase in the stock price. So if you bought, say you bought $100 of stock, and you were getting a dividend of $4 on the $100, the $100 of stock. And then the price doubles. We have one of these bull markets, and the price doubles. But the dividend is still $4. Now the dividend percentage has dropped from 4% to 2%. Well, what's happening is, for a time, the investor is happy because he's still getting the same dividend, but he had this doubling in the price. And so he had a good return. And he doesn't care. The investor doesn't care if it comes from dividends or price growth. Doesn't make any difference. He's happy. But what happens is, as the price gets more and more out of control, at the top of the bubble, we got to 3x fair value. So that stock was worth 300, and the dividend was down to a third of what it started out. It was down to a little over 1%. So what happens in a bull market is the guaranteed return, which is the dividend, gets smaller and smaller and smaller as the price gets more and more outlandish. And the investor he's not troubled because he's still getting the price growth. He's getting great returns. But after the price gets high enough, it reaches a point where it can't go higher. And so he's no longer getting the price growth. This is what happened in 2000. Stocks stopped going up. But now his dividend is low based on what he thinks the value of his stock is, which is 3x its real value. So if the stock price had always stayed the same, he would have been getting that 4% dividend every year, and he would have been happy with it. But once the price gets inflated to this crazy extent, from that point forward, the investor becomes dissatisfied. His dividend is now a small percentage of the inflated price. He's getting a little over 1%. And he's not getting the price growth anymore. And he doesn't get disgusted in 1 year. He remembers that he had great returns before. But after 2 years, he's a little disgusted. After 5 years, he's sort of really getting disgusted. As time goes on, he gets more and more unhappy. And eventually what happens is, of course, it doesn't hit everybody to the same extent. Some people are more anxious to get returns than others. Some need them more than others. Some are in circumstances where they don't need good returns. They don't really care. But others, are watching and hoping, and they're worried about their retirements. So people start to peel off. After 5 years of low returns, the low return, remember, results from the inflated return. The inflated returns cause low returns, because inflated returns reduce the dividend based on the inflated number. The dividend is really just as big as it ever was, but the problem is the investor is, in percentage terms, it's lower because the price is so inflated. So at the top of the bubble, I don't know what the dividend on U.S. stocks, it was down to a very low number. It was under 2%. I don't know what the precise number was. Very low, very low. Historically, the lowest it had ever been. So the investor gets disgusted and starts to sell. And then, of course, when the ones who are most anxious start to sell, that brings the price down for the ones who aren't anxious. And then they become more disgusted. And in layers, they get picked off. And what happens is, eventually, everybody's nervous. And then some little event happens. Like, it could be a terrorist attack. It could be bank failure, as we saw this past time. Could be, assassination of a political figure. It could be, gas price increase. Whatever it happens to be, it sends off alarm bells among, millions of anxious investors, and they all sell, and they have what's called a crash. And once you have the crash, well, now the dividend returns to a nice, healthy number. And just as people don't get disgusted quickly, in a crash, they don't recover their confidence quickly. For several years after the crash, stocks continue to do poorly. But once you've restored the dividend, you've reversed the polarity. Now, instead of the dividend causing people to become more and more disgusted over time, the dividend gives people reassurance over time. They're now getting a decent return again, even without any price increase. So now people start to gain confidence again, and then prices stabilize and eventually start going up again. So, huge bull markets cause huge bear markets. Huge bear markets cause huge bull markets. And the point of focusing on dividends is that the dividend, it's a mechanism to make this happen. And the dividend is very important. The dividend is 2/3 of your total return. So the dividend is not important in single years. You know, you can look at single years and say, I got 30% and the dividend was only 4%. You know, who cares about the dividend? It was nothing. But in other years, when your return is zero on price appreciation, the dividend's a big deal. So in the long term, the dividend's a big deal. So I think there's something to that explanation. But as I say, it strikes me as being a little too mechanistic. So I'm not thrilled with it. Well, I asked John Walter Russell, my partner in crime, how he thought the market knew, and John just gave a very simple answer, and he's probably right. Maybe I should just, make it a really short podcast and give John's answer, but he basically said, the price of stocks has to return to normal. It's sort of like, like Bill Cosby used to ask, why is there air? I mean, I felt that Frank was asking a fair question. It was an intelligent question, but his question orients in the passive model. He's thinking at this. He's thinking too much. Stocks are much more simple than the passives ever indicate. When the price is high, it's got to come down. When the price is low, it's got to come up. It's really not any more complicated than that. And John basically just said that, and that is a very simple, concise answer, and I'm not sure we can improve on it. So that's the second explanation. It's just that the price has to reflect reality. It just so happens that stocks are an asset class where the price can be wildly off from reality for a time because investors have the power to, vote themselves a pay raise if they please, but they have to pay it back. So I think that's a good answer, and that's a second answer. Now, there's a third answer I came up with. I did a little research, and I came up, there was an answer by Ed Easterling. He's the author of Unexpected Returns. And I believe that from reading Easterling, it appears that Michael Alexander, the author of Stock Cycles, which is also an excellent book, has a similar answer. And they attribute it to inflation. And I didn't study their answer carefully enough to present it myself. So if you want to check on their answer, check their work. Google Michael Alexander, Stock Cycles, or Google Ed Easterling. Ed Easterling has a website. I think it's called Unexpected Returns. I'm not sure, but check. And no, it may be called Cressmont Research. I think it may be called CressmontResearch.com. But you'll find it if you Google his name. And he has something called Financial Physics, and he goes through, what makes stock prices change. And he talks about inflation. And as I understood it, it was sort of that when during times of low inflation, stocks strike people as very good because stocks are giving this great return compared, but when inflation is high, it makes stocks look not quite as good in relative terms. And so stocks tend to be undervalued in times of high inflation. That's what I got out of it, but I didn't study it at all, so I may have it jumbled. So you need to read it yourself. But that was an explanation. So there are at least three. There's my dividend explanation. There's John's common sense explanation. And there's Ed Easterling's inflation explanation. But after thinking about those and not being entirely satisfied, I came back to a fourth explanation, which I've talked about on other podcasts, which is what I call the emotion waves explanation. And the emotion waves explanation is something I've tried to talk about in earlier podcasts, and I think it's very important, but it's hard to talk about because it's so new. People don't talk about it, and we almost need to invent a new language to talk about it. I mean, this is how primitive our understanding of stock investing is today. We don't even have words. We don't even have a vocabulary to explain the realities. We're all caught up in these logical, technical explanations. And so much of stock investing is rooted in emotion, in investor emotion, that logic just doesn't come into play. This came up, I think this was at the Shaddock's blog just the other day, and Shaddock had a blog where he was saying, oh, I think there may be a double dip in this recession. You know, we're sort of going through an improvement now, and I think we may see another dip. And then he went through some reasons, you know, about the economy. And it was all perfectly intelligent. And I said, look, I agree there's going to be another dip. I agree. But I don't agree with these explanations. They're all fine. There's nothing wrong with them. But I think people feel a need to give these logical descriptions of what's going on. Again, because they want to be in the club. This is what sells. You have to appear smart. You want to be an expert, you got to be smart. And if you say, well, you know, investors are just going to feel funny, you know, we're like, what? What are you talking about? That doesn't sound smart. Well, the reality is that's stock investing. Stock investing is not smart. It's not. Just people think it's a money subject and there has to be all this intelligence being brought to bear. And the reality is that 70% of what goes on is just Looney Tunes. So thinking that there's a logical explanation to everything just gets you off on the wrong track. It leads you down the primrose path. It gets you into dangerous territory. You don't want to do it. That's where the efficient market theory and that's where passive investing came from, this hyper-rationalizing of things. And I think we're going to have a double dip, not because of all these economic forces that Shaddock's pointed to. When we have a double dip, people will certainly be pointing to those things and attributing it to it. But that doesn't mean that's what caused it any more than the failure of the banks is what led to the great crash. The great crash was caused by the fact that stock prices were at insane levels. And when stock prices are at insane levels, you're always going to have a great crash. And the reason we're going to have a double dip is, I believe, investors, see, what's going on is emotion. People can't let in. What we've discovered during the past 9 years, since January 2000, is that passive investing doesn't work. We were told it worked. We were told there were studies. We were told the experts said it worked. We put all our retirement money in on it, and it doesn't work. And some of us, you know, learned that at earlier times, but those who didn't know learned in September of 2008. But we don't want to accept it. And so we're only letting in so much. And we're eventually going to have to let it all in order to rebuild the economy, because we destroyed our economy with this stuff. And we're going to have to let it in. And that's going to take, you know, I don't know how long. I can't tell you. 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, I don't know. But when we let it all in, there's probably going to be another crash. Probably another 50% crash. A pretty big crash. And at that point, I think all the resistance to hearing the truth about stock investing will have been worn out. And middle-class investors will say, you know what? I don't give a damn about passive investing anymore. I want to find out what works. You know what? It's worth saying I was wrong. It's worth saying the three magic words to be able to retire on time. And once we get there, you know, we're off to the races, because we've got 30 years of research showing us what works. Rational investing wasn't cooked up by Rob Bennett on a discussion board. Rational investing has been with us, well, for 30 years since Robert Shiller's research in 81. But, you know, of course, it has roots going back much further than that. Benjamin Graham wrote about rational investing in his book, Security Analysis, that was published in the 1930s. So we have, rational investing has roots going a long, long ways back. But the point here is, think about someone who learns that they have a fatal disease. You know, they hear it from their doctor. They often do not accept it when they first hear it. They will jump on anything to say, well, you know, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe I'm going to be okay. I mean, the doctor said it could be bad. I could die within a year. But he said they're looking for a cure. They're looking for a cure. So maybe there will be a cure, and maybe there will. But you know, the person's in pain, and I understand. But the person is putting the odds of that at you know, 50% when the odds are maybe 1 in 100. And in time, though, 6 months later, the person may accept it. The person may say, you know, 6 months later, you might say, oh, I'm hoping for a cure, you know. And the person might say, you know, don't hope for a cure, because I there's not going to be a cure in soon enough for me. I know I'm dying. And that's hard to hear, but it, you know, but it's healthy. It's good. You know, we all need to be real. So it takes time. The human mind cannot take it all in. Well, the same thing's true with investing. We know that passive investing doesn't work. We all know this. We're not willing to accept it. That's why there's such friction when, you know, some guy like Rob Bennett goes on a discussion board and says it out loud. It causes a mass freak out. But we all know it. And when we let it in, it's going to scare a lot of people. And those people are going to sell stocks. And we're probably going to see another 50% price drop. It's not for sure. But the odds are. So how does the market know when we've gone from the short term to the long term? Well, what's going on is that the market knows all kinds of things. You know, this is where the efficient market theory is wrong. The efficient market theory people, those are the passive investing people, they say, oh, the market incorporates everything we know about investing. Well, there's a sense in which that's true. You know, there's a sense in which it's a tautology. It's just an obvious statement that how could the market not incorporate everything we know about stocks? That's, you know, it's idiotic to think otherwise. But what the market is incorporating is not really all we know. It's incorporating all that we're willing to acknowledge we know. So if we know that passive investing has failed, but we're not yet willing to say it out loud, then we're playing a game. And we're keeping the price up for the time being, but when we let that knowledge in, the price is going to fall another 50%. So the market knows two things. The market knows that passive investing doesn't work, but the market, based on that knowledge, the PE10 level would today be 7 or 8. But the market also knows, quote unquote knows, that we're not willing to accept that today. And for that reason, the PE10 value today is 16. The market knows both things. We're not willing to incorporate that into the price yet. So the market is not efficient at all in the short term. It's wildly inefficient. Now, this explanation, I think it's the best explanation. I think that's always going on. The market is always incorporating information into the price. But the information is always filtered by emotion, by investor emotion. So all of the information available to us is not being reflected in the price, but it will be. Now there's a great paradox here. It's a painful paradox to contemplate. What I'm saying is that the market is efficient. The answer to Frank's question, how does the market know things in the long term that it doesn't know in the short term? The answer is that the market is efficient in the long term. In the long term. And not in the short term. And so the reason, you know, I often talk about how passive investors sooner or later are going to suffer bone-crushing losses. There's no way to avoid it. They're always going to suffer bone-crushing losses. There's not one exception in the historical record. Whenever investors have stopped paying attention to price, they have suffered bone-crushing losses and an economic crisis. No exceptions in the record. Passive investing never has worked and never can work. Why? The sad answer is because the market's efficient. It's the greatest irony. Because the passive investors base all of their strategies on the fact that the market's efficient. But the mistake the passive investors made was in thinking that the market is efficient instantly. The market is not efficient instantly. The market is efficient. It takes about 30 years. It's wildly inefficient in the short term. So passives buy stocks at insanely inflated prices and then suffer for decades as the price returns to normal. So there's a great amount of efficiency incorporated within 10 years, but for total efficiency, you have to wait about 30 years. But what that means is that the passive investors have the odds just tremendously against them. Their only hope is for the first time in history, the market will not become efficient, but it always does. It always does. So passive investing is an investing philosophy rooted in the idea that stocks are going to perform in the future totally different from how they've ever performed before. It's the longest of long shot strategies. There are rare occasions where it actually works, but about 1 in 10 scenarios. It's a long odds bet. Not something the middle class investor should be using to plan for his or her retirement. So what's going on is the market efficiency is catching up with us. If we ignore price and we buy at crazy prices, the long-term movement toward efficiency will crush us. And we're in the process of seeing that happen today, but the process is not yet complete. Now, the title of the podcast is "The Intrinsic Value of Stocks is a Secret We Keep from Ourselves." What I am saying is, the indexing revolution is an absolutely fantastic thing, because what we have done is we have come up with a way to invest where you don't have to research the stocks, and you know, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, you know the intrinsic value. Stocks are an asset class that in the U.S. that provides roughly 6.5% real per year. So if you know that, you're set. The problem we're suffering from today is we're trying not to know it. If you know that the return is always 6.5, how do you invest? Well, if the market returns 6.5, say the price is fair value, you know, P/10 of 14. You set your stock allocation at 60%. You get 6.5 return the first year. What do? You stay that allocation. You say the market returned what it's supposed to return. The market must still, if market was a fair price when I got in, it must still be a fair price. Everything's groovy. Now, say the market returns the next year zero. Well, you say, hey, the market returns zero. That means in the future, I'm going to get not only a return of 6.5, I'm going to get a return of 6.5 for this year, plus the return of 6.5 I never got for last year. In other words, I've now got 6.5% of returns sort of, you know, built into my future earnings. That's nice. That's probably not enough to get you to increase your stock allocation. You're going to stay at 60%, but it's a nice thing to know. Say you have 5 years in a row where stocks don't return. Well, then that future is getting built up. You got 6.5 times 5. You know, 6 times 5 is 30. So 33% return built in. Now you're going to increase your stock allocation. Instead of staying at 60, maybe you go up to 90. Because you say, in the next couple of years, I'm not only going to get 6.5 per year, I'm going to get 6.5 plus that 30% return that is owed to me that I haven't collected yet. That's if you're rational. And of course, if it works the opposite, you do just the opposite. If you start with a 60% allocation and the market returns 30% like it did in the late 90s, alarm bells are gonna ring in your head. You're gonna say, wait a minute. I'm supposed to be getting 6.5. That's what the intrinsic value tells me I should get. I got 30. That means I got 24% too much. That means my returns in the future are gonna be there's gonna be a 24% subtraction. I might not get any return now for 3 years. I don't know about this 60%. Maybe you stay for 1 year. But then the next year you get 30% again. Now you've got a built-in negative of 48%. You're going to stay at 60% stocks? I don't think so. You're going to lower your allocation to 20% or 30%. That's what rational investors should have been doing in the late 1990s when we had those insane returns. All that happened was we borrowed the money from the future, and now we're paying it back. We're in the process of paying it back. So the point is, if you know intrinsic value, you know how to invest. You don't suffer from stock crashes anymore. When the key to rational investing or to valuation-informed indexing is to understand that short-term timing never works, long-term timing always works. And people are puzzled by this because people have heard 10 kajillion times that timing doesn't work, and they're saying, Rob, you're admitting that short-term timing doesn't work, so you're not totally crazy. We acknowledge that you're half sane, but you keep saying long-term timing works, and you've got all this data showing it that it's true. But it can't be true, Rob. How could the market know? The market doesn't have a brain. How does it know? Well, the answer is the market is us, and we do have a brain. So the market does have a brain. The market borrows our brain. How do we know? Does somebody put out an announcement on the radio saying, you know, calling all S&P investors, it was okay to be passive before, that was the short term, but now it's long term. The long term has arrived. No. How do we know? The answer is we always know. Investors always know the realities. This is what I believe. We always know the realities. What passive investing is a joke we tell on ourselves. I know a girl, maybe I told this story before and I should stop picking on this poor girl. I hope she had a happy life after my knowledge of her. She was very young then and she, I think she probably did. She had it pretty well together. But there was a girl in a place I worked and I barely knew her, but everybody liked her. Nice personality. She was very attractive. She was a hard worker, did her job, just an all around, quality person. And she was dating a guy, and he had his good points. He was attractive, and he was ambitious. But he was cheating on her. And everybody knew it, and I knew it. And I didn't even work on the same floor as her, and I didn't know her. I think I ran in a race with her once. That was about it. And how do I know? I didn't even want to know it, and I knew it. And how many times you hear a story like this? You know, everybody in town knows that so-and-so is being cheated on, and the person doesn't know it. You know, and everybody's embarrassed. You know, the person's raving about their boyfriend or their girlfriend or their wife or their husband, and everybody knows the other one's cheating on them. Well, the answer is they know it. People are smart. People are not dumb. They know it. Look at the goons. You know, you could say, oh, the goons are dumb. They don't understand Rob's arguments. They're not dumb. They're smart enough to come up with all these stupid word games all the time. They're smart enough to know how to destroy discussion boards with their abusive posting. They're not dumb. They're using intelligence to do these things. They don't want to know. When humans don't want to know something, they don't know it, okay? The way it is. When your boyfriend is cheating on you, and yet you want him to be your boyfriend, you know, you remember what it was like to be lonely, and I remember. So I know that the person involved, she remembered. And in other words, we tell ourselves lies. We say, well, he's got this quality, he's got that quality, maybe he'll stop, maybe being with me will change him. You know, there's a million things. Just like the passive investors say, well, yeah, valuations, schmaluations, but, you know, maybe it's going to be different this time. You know, a lot of technology, you know, the experts, yeah, blah, 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 blah. Blah, 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 blah. We're geniuses at tricking ourselves. The way the market knows that it's turned into the long term is the market knew it all along, what the intrinsic value of stocks was. The market just decided to acknowledge what it knew. Now you could say, of course, you could take Frank's question one more step and say, well, why did the market suddenly decide to acknowledge what it always knew? Well, I think the answer to that lies in this book, The wisdom of crowds, I've talked about it before. And the wisdom of crowds argues that communities are smarter than any one person in the community. It's a very provocative argument, very interesting argument. And he looked at examples like, there were things like where a ship went down, you know, a ship that sunk. And they would want to find the location. And they would ask, you know, a guy who had studied this his whole life. And they'd say, where do you think the ship is? And he would give a reasonably good answer. But the best answer was a combination of answers of lots of people. And those answers would nail it. And the question is, how did they do it? They got these dumb people involved. How did they get it right? And he argues that communities have an insight, a wisdom that no individual, the smartest person in the world, doesn't have. And I think there's something to it. Now, he argues for the efficient market. He argues that this is true with stocks. But he has two paragraphs, and I've quoted it in another earlier podcast. I can't quote it here. I don't have it in front of me. But he has two paragraphs that explains why it doesn't work with stocks. He didn't understand what he was saying, but I do. The two paragraphs were, it doesn't work if the community bans honest posting. He didn't use those words, but that's what he was saying. He was saying, if the community blocks any of the community members from having their say, the community makes itself dumb. So what we haven't, you know, how often have you heard me talk about the ban on honest posting on the internet, on stocks? And that doesn't apply just on the internet. Robert Shiller told us in an interview not long ago that he has never told us all he knows about stocks, because if he did, he would be branded unprofessional. There's a vicious social taboo against telling the truth about how stocks work. And we all honor it to some degree. I honored it. I didn't post what I knew about safe withdrawal rates. I first started posting at Motley Fool May of 1999. I didn't tell the truth about safe withdrawal rates till May of 2002. 3 years later. The taboo and the ban on honest posting applies everywhere. So what's going on is, as a community, we know it's not hard. If you know that stocks go up 6% real per year, you don't need an IQ of 140 to know that in the late 1990s, when they were going up 30% a year, there was something fishy going on. Everybody knew it. It was in all the newspapers. Now, some knew it, you know, some knew precisely. You know, people who follow this, they knew, well, we're way, way, way above where, and others just sort of casually knew, boy, those numbers are awful high. That's vague and fluid. But we all knew it. And we all denied it. If we didn't deny it, stock prices would have came down. But we denied it. And we're able to, we have that power. We can deny it. But the trouble is, when we're denying it, it causes anxiety. When you know your boyfriend's cheating on you, you're never as happy as you could be if you didn't know it. It's always gnawing away at you. You might have some great times. Just because you suspect he's cheating on you doesn't mean you never have any good times. Now, but it does mean that there's always a dark cloud. And if it gets worse, the dark cloud gets darker. And what happened in the 90s is the dark clouds came into the picture. 1996 forward. By January of 2000, the clouds were so dark that we started to let it in, and the good times started to diminish. And we started to collectively let in what we had done to ourselves, but not all at once. We let it in a little teeny bit, and we let stocks go down a little teeny bit, and then a little teeny bit more, and then a little teeny bit more. And in September of 2008, we let stocks go down, whole big bunches. And we scared ourselves. We let them go down 50%, and that really scared us. And then we said, well, that's enough for now. Let's hold off on any more. And in the next 3 or 4 years, we're probably going to let in more. We're going to go down another 50%. So the answer is, the market knows things because the people in the market know things. Now, how do I know this is true? How do I test it? What's my study? Go to a discussion board. post what the historical data says about safe withdrawal rates. See what kind of reaction you get. You know, the reaction I get is, Rob, nobody argues with my points. Nobody offers any intellectual defense of passive investing. For 7 years, nobody has. What people say is, Rob, you're hurting our feelings. Please go away. We don't like you. I hurt their feelings because I tell the truth about stock investing. I think we need to deal with the truth. I think, you know, this is why you have the rage. You know, if you know your boyfriend's cheating on you and your girlfriend tells you that, she's not your girlfriend anymore. You hate her. Nobody wants somebody telling us the truth we're trying to deny. But I feel I have to tell this truth because what we've got with indexing is the we've got nirvana. We've got a way to know the intrinsic value of stocks without having to do all the research that Warren Buffett does. That's what John Bogle provided us. It's wonderful. But we've thrown it away with this passive investing idiocy. What we should be doing is watching each year for whether we get 6.5 real or not. And in years, you know, you don't need to change your allocation every year. You know, once every 10 years will usually do it. But when you've had 10 years where the price keeps going up, you've got to move that allocation down. And when you've had 10 years where the price keeps going down, you've got to move that allocation up. You've got to make those adjustments or your risk level gets totally bonkers. And you lose, you know, most of your retirement money, and it takes decades to recover from those losses. So you can't let that happen to you. You know, I mean, if it's already happened, it's happened, but you can't let it continue happening. You've got to stop. You've got to switch to rational. You've got to switch to valuation informed. So the answer to Frank's question, I think the short answer is we always know, but we let it in stages. And what you're watching when you watch stock prices changes, you're watching the investors let in information that they haven't wanted to hear. That's always the case. It's not these economic factors, because the economic factors don't matter. They're all factored in to the 6.5% real. And those things are going to balance out in the end. In other words, some economic developments are positive, some are negative. It doesn't really matter. They're going to average out, and it's all going to produce a long-term return of something around 6.5%, an average long-term return somewhere around 6.5% real. But you're not going to get 6.5% real if you buy at the prices that applied, excuse me, from 1996 through 2008. No way, no how. Because when you're that far, when you're at 3x fair value, yeah, the stock market's going to generate enough productivity to cover 6.5% real, but then the return, the 70% drop in price is going to wipe it out and then some. So your return is going to be a negative number. The market's going to do its thing, but because you bought foolishly, you're going to have a negative number. So that's today's sermon. I hope that answers Frank's question reasonably well. I tried to put a positive spin on it in the heading, talking about intrinsic value, because it's exciting. I remember when there was a fellow, and I don't recall his name, who posted at the Fireboard. He was a smart fellow. And I was quoting Bernstein, how Bernstein said we can know the long-term return of stocks. And I said, look, this is the key. Everybody should be listening to this. And the guy didn't want to hear it. But he respected Bernstein. And he went to his book and he pulled out a statement. And Bernstein said in it, we can never know the intrinsic value of stocks. And it was an accurate quote. You know, I checked and it was accurate. I don't have the exact words now, but that was the point being made. And it's incredible that the William Bernstein, the same person in the same book, wrote in one place, we can know the long-term return of stocks, which is what I say. And at another place in the same book, he said, we cannot know the intrinsic value of stocks. Well, you can't know the long-term return if you don't know the intrinsic value. The two statements are in contradiction. And when we resolve these contradictions, I don't mean just Bill Bernstein, I mean all of us together as a community. When we resolve these contradictions, we do something magic. We move from the passive investing model or the passive investing era to the rational investing era. And it's going to be better. It's going to be a better time. It's going to be a better place. It's going to be a richer place for all of us. We've discovered the Holy Grail. John Bogle did it. We've discovered how to determine the intrinsic value of stocks, you know, without having to work at it, you know, in 5 minutes of your spare time. But we've got to start using it. We've got to start using that great value and not throwing it away by investing in this idiotic passive way, which throws away the edge. The whole edge you get from intrinsic value is knowing when to go with a high stock allocation and when to go with a low stock allocation. And when you invest passively, you obviously throw away that advantage. So the biggest advantage indexing has brought us has been tossed into the trash by the passive investing dogmatist. I hope to change that. I come not to bury passive investing, but to save it. I should say indexing. I do come to bury passive investing. I come not to bury indexing, but to save it. I come to bury passive investing because passive investing is the thing causing us all this trouble. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.